Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Jessica Bull about her crime novel, Miss Austen Investigates. Jessica grew up in Southeast London, where she still lives with her husband, two daughters, and far too many pets. She studied English literature at Bristol University and information science at City University in London. She began work as a librarian, under the false impression she could sit around and read all day, before becoming a communications consultant. In this episode, we discuss why Jane Austen makes the perfect detective, how Jessica knew the time was right to query her dream agent, and what it's like writing a novel that went on to sell in 18 territories. But before we get into that, here's Jessica with an excerpt from Miss Austen Investigates.
To Cassandra Austen, Steventon, Wednesday, 23rd of December, 1795. My dear Cassandra, yes, I'm very sorry, but you really must keep Christmas with the fowls as planned. Take heart that you can do nothing more to further Georgie's cause in Steventon than you can in Kintbury. At this moment, your place is with your fiancé. Heaven only knows how long it will take young Mr. Fowl to reach St. Lucia and back. He could be away for as long as 2 years, and you're sure to regret passing up any opportunity to dawdle away the hours with your sweetheart once he's gone. Besides which, with all the to-ing and fro-ing to Winchester to check on our dear Georgie, my father says he can't actually spare anyone to fetch you. Now, who could have killed the hapless milliner, Madame Renaud? With the assistance of our visiting countess, I have expanded my list of potential suspects to include Sophie Rivers. Could the milliner have been hiding one of smug Sophie's secrets under her many hats? Sophie swears they never met, but perhaps she doth protest too much. Accuse me of basing my suspicions on no more than my distaste for our neighbour, if you must. But I think I have a good eye for a murderess. Your prayers are greatly appreciated, but our mother bids you also spy on Mrs. Fowle's kitchen maid and obtain the receipt for her fish sauce. The one in port wine with the anchovies? Apparently, it's Georgie's favourite and keeps very well in a bottle. Everybody's love, J.A. P.S. When you have finished reading, fold this letter into a boat and set it sailing down the River Kennet.
Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Miss Austen Investigates.
Hello, Chloe. Thank you so much for having me. It's so exciting to finally be here. It's finally my turn. As you know, I've been listening to you for ages and hearing about everybody else's debut novels. And I just can't believe it's such a dream to finally be in the hot seat.
So lovely of you. Thank you, Jessa. I was just saying to you before you recorded, it feels like I've been making this podcast for 5 minutes. So it's lovely that you've been listening for so long. So kick us off then. Start by telling us what Miss Austen Investigates is all about.
Okay, so it's a Jane Austen inspired murder mystery. So it starts with a young Jane Austen. She's only 19. She's at a ball. She's trying to have a romantic time with a certain young man called Tom Lefroy. But Sadly, that's interrupted by the discovery of a milliner found bludgeoned to death. And Jane wants to solve the crime, firstly because she knew and she respected the milliner, and then her brother Georgie is arrested in connection with the crime, and she has to solve it, otherwise he'll be hanged.
Yeah, and maybe this is a stupid question, but did the novel start with Jane Austen and your love for Jane Austen? I mean, I've seen you in your amazing Regency outfits. Did it start there, or did it start with wanting to write like a murder mystery novel?
So I have been a Jane Austen fan ever since Colin Firth walked out of that pond in the 1995 BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. And it just slowly kind of crept up on me over the years. I just watched every adaptation. I read every book. I visited their homes. I read every biography, everything I could get my hands on. And then I'm also a huge crime fan as well. So I worked in libraries for a long time. And one of the things that I really loved about working in the library was talking to people about what they were reading. And my patrons at the library really introduced me to crime fiction and got me hooked on people like P.D. James, who wrote Death Comes to Pemberley. So it started with Jane Austen. And what I really wanted to do was to make a tribute to her life. So I think we sometimes get her confused with her characters and think that life was easy for her and that writing came easy and that publication and success came easy, when it really didn't at all. And I wanted to tell the story of this amazing, resilient and determined woman who overcame all these obstacles. But I wanted to do it in a fun and exciting way. And I was already kind of playing with the idea of writing a historical mystery. And what I realised I needed to do was to really lean into that and make Jane Austen my star and give her a murder to solve. And yeah, that's how it happened.
I wondered, like, if you're choosing a real life person, and obviously Jane Austen's long gone, but did you almost feel like a bit naughty for kind of almost taking her life?
Absolutely. I felt very naughty. The realization, because I've watched like all the big films portraying her, and I never really felt that they captured the essence of who I thought she was. Like, I really enjoyed them, but I don't think they got over how funny and how joyful she was. So there came this realization where I thought, well, you're a writer, Jessica. Why don't you try writing about her? And at first I was terrified. I was too scared to do it because it was such a big thing to do and so naughty to do that to such a respected icon of English literature. So I kind of crept my way in. So as I mentioned, I was already writing mystery, and the novel I wrote before this, which is my novel In the Drawer, was kind of based on Jane Austen, but I didn't call her Jane Austen. So she was born in the same, my protagonist was born in the same year. She had a sister she was really close to. And I knew it was working because I'd share it with my writing group and they'd say things to me like, she's very Lizzie Bennet, isn't she? And so I knew there was something there. But yeah, it took me a while to develop the confidence to really, really grab hold of it and lean into it and just celebrate it.
Almost feels like you needed permission to use her name. And
it is.
I think it's great. I mean, I will confess now that I'm not particularly knowledgeable on Austen at all. And I've only read two of her novels. But I've been told there are lots of kind of Easter eggs for the Jane Austen fans embedded into the novel. How fun was that for you to do?
It was incredibly fun. So tell me which ones you've read.
Pride and Prejudice, of course.
Yes.
And I have to say that whereas most people grew up loving Pride and Prejudice, I hadn't seen the adaptation or read the book till much later in my life. I was brought up on Sense and Sensibility, and I adored the Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet film, and I would always watch that when I was off sick from school, get the VHS out, watch that, have a cry, you know, enjoy the period costume and all that. So that was my kind of film. And then I remember when I was 18, we were told in the summer holidays, our English teacher said, you have to read a classic. So I was like, right, I'm going to read Pride and Prejudice, sorry, I'm going to read Sense and Sensibility because I know it so well. And I found it really hard, but that's an 18-year-old, you know. So,
yeah.
But I don't know the books like so well. So
I think
don't
that's
know
why that the adaptations to are important, because they bring us to it, don't they? They're really, really important.
Yeah.
So it was enormous fun, and it's so funny to talk to people now about the book and what Easter eggs they particularly enjoyed and what they saw in it, because I've realised that I've done things that I didn't really realise that I was doing at the time, because Austin had just worked her way inside my imagination and took over, that when I want to explore a scene, I'll inadvertently kind of draw on that inspiration. So lots of people say that in this book, they notice parts of Jane as Lizzie Bennet or Jane as Emma, particularly when she's, you know, does something a bit mortifying. But what I was really, really drawing on for this first book was Northanger Abbey. So Northanger Abbey was the first Austen I read, and it's got the most in common with a murder mystery in some senses. And all Jane Austen's novels have a lot in common with murder mysteries, because they're all essentially novels where the heroine has to find out the true character of those around her. And she kind of does that by interrogating the stories that she's told and testing what she knows about the hero. So this was very much my tribute to Northanger Abbey, which of course Catherine Morland gets so carried away with trying to find out the history of her family, of the hero's family, that she accuses his dad, General Tilney, of murdering his wife and makes a real blunder there. So, and it was important for me to draw on that inspiration, because Northanger Abbey is Jane Austen's tribute to the Gothic and to women writers of her time. And what I was trying to do was to build that same kind of tribute that was inspired by Austen, but wasn't exactly the same, that still contained, you know, my own voice and my own style of writing.
Yeah, that was one thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, because your book does have that kind of observational comedy, well, not comedy, but wit, and the kind of, you know, you write in the third person of this kind of like all-seeing narrator. So I was thinking as I was reading it, like, this does fit nicely alongside Austen's canon. And was that your intention to write it that way?
Yeah. So it's, yeah, I didn't want to fall into the trap of writing a pastiche. And it's really overwhelming kind of trying to write in kind of Austen's tone, because obviously you're inviting comparison to the greatest novelist who ever lived, and you know it's never gonna go well. She's always gonna win. There's only one Jane Austen, and she's absolutely brilliant. She's a genius, and yeah, you know, it's not great to be compared to her. But she's influenced my writing and my imagination so much that rather than kind of fight against that and try and write something very different or try and be original for the sake of being original, which I think we all feel when we're younger, I think as I've got older, I've kind of enjoyed turning that on its head and learning what I can from her and really leaning into that style and that inspiration. There's a novel called The Confessions of Franny Langton by Sarah Collins. And in that, there's a really lovely quote when she says that men write to distinguish themselves from the literary canon, whereas women write to join in. And I think Austen did that, and that is exactly what I was trying to do here. So I did study her tone, and particularly when I was writing the letters from Jane to her sister Cassandra. And it's lovely that you mentioned the comedy, because the other thing that I really, really enjoy about an Austen novel is the comedy, is all the laughs, is all the satire. And I did try and work out how she constructed a joke and what I could learn from that. And I always said that what I really wanted this novel to be was kind of one third biographical fiction, one third literary criticism, and 100% murder mystery.
I love that. Well, talking of the kind of biographical element of it, I know you've done an insane amount of research, but obviously just for your own enjoyment as well. How did you then decide kind of the gaps in Jane's life and what you could, I guess, what you could use in this and what you were happy to just make up yourself? How did you kind of decide those areas to play with?
It's such a paradox, because we feel like we know a lot about Austen and who she was, but at the same time, we really don't. So unlike lots of other writers, she never kept a journal. She never left us a journal anyway. And then her sister Cassandra burnt the vast majority of her letters. deliberately to kind of protect her. And the story that we have about Austin is very much filtered through her family, her Victorian relatives, and they were trying to protect her reputation after, you know, the reputations of other women writers like Mary Wollstonecraft had been trashed. So we do know a lot about her, but at the same time, we don't really know much about her at all. And for me, this was a project was all about getting as close to her as possible. So I challenged myself to keep the story as close to the truth as possible and to make it as authentic as possible. So even down to the motivation for Jane getting involved in the crime and the crime itself. So one of the things that we don't know much about is her brother George, who had epilepsy and learning difficulties. And I always felt he'd been really unfairly erased from the narrative of her life when, you know, the records show that the family cared for him and he was very much part of the Austin set until the day he died. He was looked after and cared for by his relatives in terms of, you know, how they arranged for him to be taken care of. And then the other thing that we do know about, which the family probably didn't want us to know about, is the story of her aunt, so Mrs. Lee Perot, who in 1799 was arrested for shoplifting a card of lace in Bath. And the lace was worth about 60 shillings, and this was a capital crime in Georgian England. So she stood trial, and if she'd have been found guilty, she would have been, it was a capital crime, so, but given the low value of the lace, she probably would have been transported to Australia for 14 years instead. Wow. Yeah, and it was so serious that her husband was like preparing to make this move to Australia. But she was acquitted, but it was a big kind of, you know, really upset the family at the time. And I was thinking about her and I was reading one of the few letters where Georgie's parents mention him. And his dad, Mr. Austin, is reflecting on his condition. And he says, "We have this consolation. He cannot be a bad or wicked child." And it just spoke to me, like, this is someone they loved and they wanted to protect and they knew that was vulnerable. And so with that terrible imagination of a novelist, I thought, oh, what if I put Georgie in the position that she was in? Would that be enough? Would that be authentic enough to spur my Jane into solving her first mystery?
And it absolutely is. And what I love is that you used that tiny little nugget that you found in your research and it spun this whole narrative for you. I mean, imagine if you hadn't come across that line and you hadn't off. It's mad when, you know, one line in a bit of research can really take you on the whole journey of your novel. And I find that amazing when you talk about kind of inspiration. There are obviously so many, and you must have loved kind of constructing this novel, because there's so many aspects of the Regency era and that we see in Austen's novels, but that you've brought in. So you have things like the balls and the reputation of the family and marriage and all the matches and things. And how did you choose which parts of the era would fit with building a crime? Because essentially you are making sure that this is a murder mystery and that's the heart of the story, but you've got to make the era authentic. I mean, I know you're, you know, as I've seen your amazing outfits, if anyone hasn't seen you dressed up, I'm going to direct them to your social media pages so they can see you in your outfits. But how did you kind of construct this historical era then and decide what was going to fit into your story and what was going to be left behind?
Well, it's really funny because what I was really concerned about are what are the motivations for the crime and how can I give everybody, all this cast of characters, the motivations that might lead to a crime. And as you really think about it, you realise that those motivations are the same drivers for the things that are driving lots of the characters in Austen's novels. So it's, you know, it's money, it's reputation, it's sex. And her novels do verge on the darker side. So she was very, very interested in law, and she was very interested in the way that the law systematically disadvantages women. So if you think about Pride and Prejudice, the whole plot of that drives on the fact that women are barred from inheriting Longbourn. And then there's this tension between what is morally acceptable and what is legal. So the big crime that we would consider a crime today in Pride and Prejudice is Wickham grooming and abducting 15-year-old Lydia is not a crime in Georgian England. And in fact, it's Lydia who'll be punished if he doesn't marry her. So there was a real harmony there, I think. And then the other thing that I was really trying to do was to make sure that the things that Jane's characters, that Austin's characters do, and that she did in real life, are essential to solving the crime, and to do that in a way that the small details of women's lives matter, just like she did in her novels. So I have her doing things like, I think, thought about what would she know about, what does she do? So she calls on her neighbours and she interviews them, and she goes shopping, and she knows about cloth, and she knows where various materials come from and how they're made, and she instructs her servants. And then I just got so carried away with that that there is a ball scene in the middle of the novel where Jane goes to a ball at the assembly rooms, and the only way that she can solve the crime is by dancing with as many gentlemen as possible. And obviously that's me just getting really, really carried away with that whole concept of how can Jane be a detective.
I love that. I love that so much. I mean, who doesn't want a dancing detective? I mean, it just is brilliant. I always ask this, particularly of people who write crime or mystery novels, and so many people surprise me with their answer. But I always imagine, if you're a crime writer or a murder mystery writer, you have, you know, your post-it notes, your really detailed plans, and your you know, whiteboard in your office, or things with scribbled notes on. And then a lot of people tell me that they're not a planner, but are you a big planner, Jess?
I'm a big planner, and I'm evangelical about planning, because it was only when I started planning that my writing really broke through and began to take off. So yeah, and I think it's really important with mystery, because every mystery is a story where the protagonist is uncovering another story. So it's really complicated, and I really want my readers to like trust me to lead them through that. So yeah, I think that, you know, planning pays off, definitely.
What's your kind of your general kind of writing process like? Are you a kind of like scrappy writer in terms of finding little bits of time in the day that you sit and write, or do you kind of carve out blocks of time? Are you a early morning writer, late night writer? What's your kind of general routine look like?
So my perfect writing day, and obviously it's not often that we have these like perfect writing days, but this perfect writing day is I'll drop my kids off at school at about 8, and I'll come back, and that first few hours are absolutely precious, and in terms of like my concentration and my creativity, and I'll write and write and write until about lunchtime, and then I'll take my dog for a walk. Listening to music, normally I always have a playlist that like has the mood for each project that I'm working on, and then I'll come back and do another kind of like quick burst. I think 90 minutes is the longest that anybody should ever be asked to concentrate for, so I try and do two bursts of 90 minutes, and then after that my kids come home and everything goes to pop.
And we talked about a little bit about your planning and research, but when you came, obviously you've done a lot of reading just out of your own interest, but when it came to writing a novel, did you keep having to dip back into it or go and find things out, or were you the kind of person that leaves yourself notes in your manuscript like XXX must find out this later, or were you always dipping back into it?
Yeah, so it was helpful that I'd done so much reading, and that the story was informed by the research rather than having to do the research to back up the story. And the other thing is, I quite like doing lots of drafts. So I'll do a first really scrappy draft, and I'll try and write that quite quickly, and probably do most of the research at that stage, so that if I know that I've got a scene that, you know, deals with the legal system at the time, so I'll do that research then, or if I'm, you know, thinking about what Jane might be wearing or what she might be eating, I'll look up that research then, and not worry too much about the writing at a line level at that stage, and then I'll go over it and over it and over it and over it and over it, and, you know, end up with like, you know, version like 54 or whatever saved somewhere, so that by that time hopefully it's kind of like smoothed out and the research is not so obvious. I'm not trying to like shoehorn things in.
And what was the most challenging part of writing this book, do you think?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So I really love the blank page and the creativity at the beginning, and I love the research. Like, you know, I feel like some of us historical novelists write novels in order to justify the research because we just love doing the research. So I really love that part of it, and I love the process and getting lost in it, and the days where you just, you know, you can't get your head out of the manuscript, you're just so there. I find it really difficult as it gets close to the end and I'm on like my third round of proofs or whatever, and I'm just saying to the proofreader, oh, can we just like move this he says she says to there, and then it comes back again and I'll have changed my mind and I'll be like, oh sorry, I know I said that, but can you just move it there. So I hate it when I have to draw a line under it and I have to finish it and everything's final and set in stone, and that makes me really anxious, and I never know when the perfect point to let go is.
It's hard for anyone, isn't it, because I think even if you'd published a book 10 years ago and you'd look at it now and think, oh, I wouldn't have written that, or I would have changed this, or would have deleted that sentence. And I almost think it's like they say with paintings, you know, they're never finished, they're abandoned, or whatever the phrase is. And I always think it's exactly the same. Like we could, you know, rearrange our words and swap things around and edit them forever, and they still wouldn't be finished in our mind, because what you have in your head is your perfect novel cannot possibly be on the page, but you have to try and get it as close as possible, and it's really hard.
It is really hard, and it's good in a way because I think that means you're still learning, you've still got that eye to improve it. And I think, you know, if there ever comes a day where I read something I've written and think, that's it, I've nailed it, I couldn't write anything better, then I'd be really scared, because where do you go from there?
So can you tell us a bit about your story of how you came to get an agent? I know you said you've been writing your whole life, but what was the point where it kind of got really serious for you?
So I had a kind of false start about kind of 12 years ago, where I wrote my first novel and queried it and got some great feedback, but didn't really realize how lucky I was to have that great feedback, because it wasn't like, we're going to publish this, your novel immediately, it's perfect. It was like, go away, rewrite this, and then submit it again to agents. So I got very dispirited after that. And I had young children as well, so it's really difficult to write when you've got young children. And so I kind of put that on the shelf for a little while, and I just concentrated on my my full-time job and reading and just, you know, enjoying books. And then I sat down and started writing again in about 2020 when, you know, the world kind of really got quite hard for a lot of people, including my family. I think writing again was my way of staying sane, really, throughout that time. And I wrote three novels. This was the third novel during that time, and started querying it at the end of 2021. And I think it's important to tell this because, like, for most of us, it takes time to learn the craft and to put yourself out there and to learn how the whole querying process works. So it was the third novel that I'd ever queried. And I knew something was different straight away because I started getting full requests straight away. And then because I'd kind of done so much kind of research around the process, I knew that was the best time for me to submit to my dream agent. And so I did that, and I sent it to Juliet Mushins, and by some miracle she came back within 24 hours and requested the full. And then just over a week later she offered to represent me. So it's one of those stories where it took me a lifetime to achieve that overnight success. And then it was wonderful because she helped me edit it. I knew that there were things that I needed to improve about the novel, and we did three rounds of edits together. And then when it went on submission, I was really fortunate to get a preempt request straight away, but I didn't take that because I was just like in a rabbit in a headlights, really. I didn't know what to do. And I met several publishers who were interested, and it ended up going to auction. And that was a really wonderful process for me because it meant I got to meet each of the editors who might take it on and understand how they all might have a different vision for the book. So some were like, can you make it scarier? Some were like, can you make it funnier? And I went with Penguin Michael Joseph because my editor there was like, let's really get the sensitivity issues in the novel right, because it is a quite diverse novel, and that was really important to me in writing it. I wanted to show how much more diverse Jane Austen's life was than we might think it was when we look at those, you know, wonderful adaptations. So yeah, it was wonderful to get to meet everyone and get a real sense of control over the whole process. And I definitely made the right choice. It's been wonderful working with them. And then after that, I was really fortunate because the international deal started coming in, and I think I'm up to 18 territories at the moment.
Wow.
I know.
That's so incredible. I think it's that thing, isn't it? Like, obviously kind of that cozy crime mystery is so popular, but also Jane Austen is like so quintessentially English that it's like catnip for international countries. They're like, oh, you know, this historical figure that's everyone knows and it's really popular. So I can see why that would be. I find that the conversations you had with different editors so interesting, because you tend to think that, I mean, obviously you in your head know what you want the book to be, but it's so fascinating that different editors can have different visions of where they want the book to go, or how they're going to market it or pitch it. And I find that whole thing so interesting, and it's that careful choice of picking the person that's kind of in line with what you want the book to be.
Absolutely.
I'm just interested to ask, the books that you queried with before this one, were they similar in terms of, were they historical, were they crime, like,
No, I think that was part of the problem. It took me a long time to find my genre and to get the confidence. So that first one that I queried back in, I think it was like 2010, was a contemporary romance. So you can see that the Jane Austen kind of, you know, the obvious thing to do when you're a Jane Austen fan is to write a contemporary romance. And the feedback that I got for that was like, the description's really lovely, but nothing happens. It's a bit boring. You make something happen. So, okay. And then the second book I queried in like 2020, it was absolutely unpublishable, probably. It was no genre. It was kind of like a feminist revenge thriller set in this kind of medieval fantasy world, really, because I wanted to write historical fiction, but I couldn't be bothered to do any research. I didn't know how to go about doing the research. And I was like, how can I make a plot? That was a lesson in building a plot. And then, Yeah, the third novel I wrote was my first attempt at historical. And it's one of those funny things where you don't realise how much you don't know about something until you've done it. And then you realise how far away you are away from it. And I kind of got to the point where I would have queried that. And then Miss Austen Investigates was my side project. And again, that was trying to do too much. It was a romance and it was a mystery. And it was like dual timeline and it was like multi-POV. And it was just like, okay, how do I just take this right back and write something like really contained and do that really, really well.
Absolutely. So as we're speaking, your book is days away from being published. I wondered how you're feeling, how you've coped with all the publishing ups and downs, and what you think, what you wish you'd known way back when you signed your contract about how to cope with all the kind of emotional highs and lows, or even the practical things like the lingo that publishers use that you think, I've got no idea what this means. So how has it been for you?
So I think I've had a really fortunate experience, definitely, and I don't feel wise enough to pass on any like nuggets of wisdom yet, but I think one thing that has really helped is letting myself kind of really embrace the whole publishing world. So doing things like listening to your podcast, like all through this journey, has been really helpful for understanding how different people's experiences play out. And then connecting with other writers over social media and going to writing festivals has been really important to me, because it means that I've managed to build this support network around me of other authors and other debut authors, and kind of keeps me grounded. And it means that when I'm having like a crisis of, should I be doing this? Should I be doing more? What should be happening with the book at this point? I can ask those people, and they're all wonderfully like supportive and generous with their time and advice. And yeah, that's definitely helped keep me sane throughout the whole process. So that's the one thing that I would say is put yourself out there and learn as much as you can, hear as many different experiences as you can, and try and get a support network around you.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes such a huge difference, I think, because it's a weird industry in some ways, and friends that are outside of it, it's hard to explain kind of the minutiae.
Oh, it's impossible to explain. Yeah. It's impossible to explain to anybody who's not a writer how anxious and nervous I'm feeling this week, because everyone's like, you should be drinking champagne for breakfast, you've done it, it's amazing, it's about to happen. But obviously I'm like, oh, you feel like this sense of like about to be kind of exposed in a way. And it's really nerve-wracking, and it's only your writer friends that can say, look, yeah, it's okay, don't worry, just take some quiet time, you know, don't worry.
Yeah, I think it's just about making some time for yourself away from the book world for a bit, and then go back to it when you're feeling like you've re-energized and you're ready to read the comments, or, well, not the reviews. We do not encourage reading reviews on this podcast.
I wish I was the kind of person that could not read reviews.
Oh no, really, if you've fallen down the rabbit hole of reading reviews.
Yeah, I do. And it's not really helpful. I mean, it's lovely when they're nice, but you know, the human brain is like programmed to look at threats. So obviously it's only the bad ones that we dwell on.
And that it's only the bad ones you remember. That's the thing. So that's why you shouldn't read them, and you should get a trusted friend to read the good ones to you. Or send them to you and just ignore. I think, I don't know, maybe people will have different experiences, but my experience was, at the beginning, I was reading every review because it was a novelty and I was curious to what people were saying. And then it got to a point where I read a not so great review, and it was it kind of picked apart my insecurities. And then I thought, okay, I don't need to read anymore. And from that moment, I've never read a single review since.
I really want to get to that point.
It kills.
I want to be you when I grow up.
I think in a couple of months you will reach that point, because people will probably say the same lovely things about your book, and it will get to the point where you think, I know that now. Or like, I know how people are feeling. I know that people are loving this, or they're really enjoying this, and you won't need to read them anymore, and you'll kind of move past it. I think that's how it goes for most people, but you'll have to stop yourself before you read any bad ones.
Good.
So, finally, can you tell us what you're writing next? I have heard a little tease because in the copy that I read, there was a little tease at the back of the book that there is a sequel in the works. So, Jess, please tell us more.
Absolutely, there's a sequel in the works. So this series is all about looking at the major events and the major relationships that shaped Jane Austen's life, and pairing that with a murder mystery. And it's also about looking at her books and creating a set of shadow books that don't, not necessarily retellings, but they do look at the same themes. And you might be excited to know that the next one is very much inspired by Sense and Sensibility.
Oh,
So, Jane has to travel to Kent to help look after her wealthy brother Neddy's children for the summer. And when she gets there, she realizes that her time would be better spent investigating the mysterious young woman who is claiming to be a shipwrecked princess and seeking refuge with his adoptive mother, Mrs. Knight, and thereby threatening the much anticipated inheritance that all of the Austens have come to rely on.
brilliant. Oh, that's exciting. I'm very intrigued by the Sense and Sensibility link. You're talking about Darcy riding out of the, well, coming out of the lake. My memory of Sense and Sensibility is Willoughby, although boo hiss, walking in the rain carrying Marianne with her broken and or sprained ankle, and you're just like, ah, oh, until you realize that he's a wrong'un. And I think that's what, when you talk about how what a good fit Jane Austen is with kind of crime, I think she does the twist very well, the kind of,
She does.
it pulls the rug out under you, and the character that you're a bit suspicious of, and then they have this kind of secret history about them, and I think that works really well. So I'm very excited to hear about the sequel, and wish you good luck with the publication of both. Jess, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
That was Jessica Bull talking about her crime novel, Miss Austen Investigates, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors, and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
50-80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.